From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Lawmakers can now receive the COVID-19 vaccine, according to Governor J.B. Pritzker's office.
I'm waiting my turn. I think it's important for many of us to set an example in that way. Many legislators asked if they could be vaccinated, but we need the state of Illinois and its legislature and its government to function.
So we need more people, not just vaccinators, but navigators and community organizations that can help with identifying people who have to get the vaccine, that can't do it through the traditional methods that have been established and can be led to the vaccine.
That's the Illinois Department of Public Health Director Ngozi Ezike. She spoke at a congressional hearing on what's needed to improve the vaccine rollout. Meanwhile, Governor J.B. Pritzker has moved lawmakers up in line to get vaccinated, a controversial decision that some say smacks of political favoritism. We'll talk about that and more coming up on this episode of State Week. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford. Our panel today includes Charlie Wheeler, an emeritus professor and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield, and also a longtime State House reporter and observer. Also with us, we have Hannah Meisel, NPR Illinois Government and Politics reporter. And joining us today, we have Jerry Nowicki. He is with Capital News, Illinois. And Jerry, thanks for joining us once again.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Jerry, let me go to you first. Talk a little bit here about maybe the good news in the fight against the pandemic. All of the state now under what is known as Phase 4 of the coronavirus plan, allowing restaurants to open for limited indoor dining, youth sports can resume. This move is due to factors like the positivity rate dropping across the state, and for now things seem to be better than I think what some were predicting going into the winter, when we kept hearing it was going to be a long, cold, dark winter in the state because of COVID-19. Right now, at least, things seem to be looking up a bit.
Yeah, the positivity rate just keeps going down. It's as low as it's been since early October. Through the weekend, it might even move to lower than 3% possibly. I think it was at about 3.4%. And then the other side of that is, as that goes down, usually it corresponds with less pressure on the hospital system. And we are seeing that. There are far fewer COVID-19 patients hospitalized now than there was in the height of this second wave that we just went through. There's fewer than half of the COVID-19 hospitalizations than at the peak of the second wave in November. It might have lasted into December, but things are just looking up. I don't know if the tier three mitigations themselves and then the heightened realization for people maybe masking up a little more efficiently or staying in a little bit more or avoiding certain situations. It certainly helped suppress the positivity rates and the spread of the virus.
Yeah, Hannah, I don't want to give people false hope here, though. There are a lot of problems that are still out there when it comes to the vaccine, rolling that out, and also concerns about these variants that could be coming from other locations and starting now to creep up here in Illinois.
That's right. I mean, it was yesterday on Thursday when Region 4, which is the Metro East, finally got out of any mitigations. And that was the first time that all 11 regions of the state had been, totally without any sort of mitigation since literally mid-August. So that's great, the numbers go down day by day. I think we all learned in algebra in high school about, exponential growth and exponential decay, but still it's interesting to see it play out in real life. But, everyone's being pretty cautious, at least, from the governor's office standpoint and IDPH, because we do have these new, more contagious variants, the variants from the UK, from South Africa. There might even be one from Los Angeles. That's still not totally confirmed. But these are places where, kind of COVID has been left to grow and mutate. And, a lot of mutations for viruses are actually not helpful to the virus. But unfortunately, these are mutations that are helpful for the virus. They're more contagious, and looks like Some vaccines are going to be effective against them, but still a lot that we don't know. So essentially we're in a race right now between trying to vaccinate enough folks and, you know, these new variants creeping up. And CDC says that it might be the UK variant B.1.1.7 might be the dominant strain in the US by mid-March. And so, we're just in a race, and vaccine rollout still going slower than anticipated. But like Jerry mentioned, I mean, things are looking up, but still the governor's office has had to answer, you know, a lot to answer for why we are ranked, you know, so low on, you know, states being able to get these first vaccines into people's arms. They've been pretty defensive the last 2 weeks about rollout and blaming, you know, especially this long-term care facility partnership between Walgreens and CVS for being, you know, slower than they wanted. I think we discussed that at length last week, but this week, Illinois is reclaiming nearly 100,000 doses of the vaccine from that program and be able to vaccinate folks who are in this more general category of 1B.
Yeah, Charlie, the state, like Hannah mentioned, reclaiming some of that vaccine, also announcing some opening of more sites, places where people can be vaccinated, including a couple run by the National Guard. The governor responding to criticism, is that what you think is going on here?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. And part of it also is that, as we've said before, the federal government did a heck of a job in terms of getting a vaccine developed, several vaccines developed with that Operation Warp Speed, but then they sort of left it up to the individual states to figure out how are we going to get these vaccines into the arms of our citizens. There was no overall national plan, and I think that's been changing with the change in administration. There's more certainty for the vaccine providers in how many doses we're going to get, and so they're able to plan out instead of not knowing how many vaccines we're going to get next week. So we have to be careful when we vaccinate this week and save enough for second shots. Now it's going to be a lot better, I think. In Illinois, the city of Chicago had its own program, the state of Illinois, and then the commercial pharmacies were supposed to do, as Hannah said, they were supposed to take care of people in nursing homes and assisted living facilities. And for whatever reason, and whoever is to blame, the fact of the matter is that they were really slow to get that taken care of, which was why the governor was able to divert some of the vaccines going directly to these pharmacies to be able to use them on other people. So I think we really are ramping up. At one point, we were kind of at the bottom of the barrel of all the states. Now I think we're closer to the bottom of the upper of the bottom half, I guess would be the way to put it, in terms of actually being getting our people vaccinated.
And earlier we mentioned that Ngozi Ezike, the state public health director, was speaking to a congressional panel about the need to improve the vaccine rollout. She talked about some of the things the state needs there. Hannah, when I look back at some of the things that the top officials are saying, almost that they weren't ready for, or seemed to be almost like they weren't prepared for the fact that that some seniors might not be as computer literate and be able to navigate the system the way that it was set up. That seems kind of surprising that they wouldn't have figured that out before now.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, every time I've asked the governor a couple times now, and his answer has basically been, well, you know, we think that most people will have some sort of access, well, whether that's like through someone else. And, you know, he's encouraging younger folks to connect with the older folks in their lives and try to help them schedule appointments. That's not even the only issue. I mean, there are many folks, you know, whether they're in rural areas or, you know, parts of the city where there's just transportation deserts, you know, don't have their own car, that actually getting to a vaccination site is going to be an issue. And I've asked the governor about that too. And, you know, he said, well, you know, we're working on maybe something like that, but like just nothing specific. And you do have to wonder, you know, why weren't these contingency plans in place, you know, months ago? And if they are, then why aren't they being made clear? But, you know, there's a lot of equity issues. And for an administration that claims to always have equity top of mind, you know, I see plenty of, you know, lawmakers out there. You know, I just saw a preview for, you know, a special report on Chicago TV featuring Representative LaShawn Ford, who represents Chicago's West Side, saying, you know, this is a failure of the administration, you know, leaving out a ton of people. You know, there's also pharmacy deserts, you know, not just in the city, but plenty of places. And a lot of the nearly 400 vaccination sites that Illinois has going right now are these, you know, are these mass, these big corporate pharmacies, Walgreens and CVS. And not every place in Illinois has that.
You're listening to State Week. I'm Sean Crawford, along with Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and Jerry Nowicki with Capital News Illinois. And Jerry, one of the decisions the governor made this week, which got some headlines, and a bit controversial, was a decision to move up state lawmakers in line for getting their COVID-19 vaccine. This, you know, for some of them, they may qualify under certain phases that are either at or coming, but for a lot of them, they would be waiting quite a while. And I guess the governor made the decision after he heard from several of these lawmakers to make this move now and allow them to get their vaccines. And it sounds like that will be happening very soon.
Yeah, they've been added. The 177 lawmakers, I think, are added into phase 1B. So sort of have the same opportunities to get the vaccine now. The governor, I think he just wants lawmakers back, taking some action, you know, doing the business of the state. For whatever reason, Illinois hasn't been doing that at the same rates that you see in some other states or even in the U.S. Congress. They're convening and whatnot, but Illinois hasn't been. If this is an action for maybe the governor to try to pull back some of the stops for that and maybe get lawmakers meeting again, that seems like what it could be. And other than that, I mean, they're just meeting virtually right now. So I think whatever he's got to do to speed up legislative activity in Illinois.
And Jerry, they did meet for the lame duck session, as we like to call it, in January for a few days downtown in Springfield at a convention center. The House met there, at least. But both the House and Senate got a bit of a scare because there were cases, positive cases, that came out of that meeting, and many people had to quarantine, that type of thing. So did that sort of, you think that may have spurred this decision as well?
I think it did, and I think it probably spurred some of their decisions to be 90-95% remote for this month, possibly into next month. I'm not 100% sure when they'll return, but yeah, I think that would make lawmakers a little bit reticent to return to the Capitol in the confined settings.
Yeah, and Charlie, Republicans were quick to pounce on this, but also some other folks who said, hey, you know, there are people who really are in need of this vaccine. They may have some underlying health issue that they should be getting it before, especially if vaccines are in limited supply. Is that fair criticism here?
Yeah, I think it is. And as Mark Brown, the Sun-Times columnist, pointed out, well, if you're going to do it, make sure that they're in the same boat as everybody else, the senior citizens who are calling hundreds of times and can't get an appointment. Don't give legislators special treatment. You put them into this category along with the senior citizens, but don't give them a special treatment. And I would argue that this notion that, oh, we have to get them back to do work, I think that's kind of spurious. And the reason I say that is, anyone who watches the legislature knows that the first couple months are mostly committee work. There's not that much significant floor action. And so when the House meets next week to adopt rules that will allow for remote committee hearings, they should be able to carry on pretty much as they've done in the past in terms of what the workload is. Now, there'll be less opportunity for people to buttonhole folks around the rotunda. Lobbyists won't have the same access as they've had in the past, but I think we'll be able to get by. And one of the flaws, the notion is, well, we have to vaccinate the lawmakers so they can come back and work, is what about the staff? If I'm not mistaken, the positive cases in the Capitol and at the convention center last month were not all lawmakers. Some of them were staff. Are we going to be able to vaccinate the staff as well? If not, I would argue that you're still going to have the possibility of a super spreading event if you have a whole bunch of people coming together who have not been vaccinated, even though some of them have. And it's still not really clear, I don't believe, whether once I'm vaccinated, I'm protected. But does that mean also that should I be infected, although the virus won't hurt me, I will be unable to pass that virus on to someone else? I think that's still an open question. So I would argue that it would be more prudent for the legislature to proceed as they're doing with the remote committee hearings until the vaccines are more widely available, more people have been vaccinated, and there's less chance of having a spread among staff people who, by the way, all go home. A lot of them have families. A lot of them have older relatives who may be particularly susceptible because of health conditions. I just think that, as I say, I think the wise move is to continue to meet remotely.
Yeah, Hannah, what do we know as far as how that's going to work? Are staff going to be allowed to also get this? I haven't heard that so far.
No, I mean, the advocacy on behalf of lawmakers was, as far as I know, only for lawmakers, but lawmakers would not be able to get anything done if it weren't for staff. And so, you know, as staff members, there are obvious, it's definitely a young person's game, but you definitely see a lot of folks who have been there for years, decades, and, you know, they're definitely more susceptible. But what Charlie said is true. You know, most of February and March is committee work anyway in the General Assembly. But, you know, it's also about public perception. Oh, my God, lawmakers are refusing to go to Springfield and refusing to work, blah, blah, blah. I mean, obviously, it's not true. But to a certain extent, there is that public perception. And you know, maybe people will forget about it and get over it in a couple of weeks, but maybe not.
Let me switch off to a different topic here. A person we haven't talked about in at least a couple of years, I would think, was Sam McCann, and he's a former Republican state senator from Carlinville, ran as a third-party candidate for governor in 2018. Now he faces some legal trouble. Jerry, you've been covering this. What's going on?
Yeah, so long story short is prosecutors allege he has been using the campaign fund for quite a few personal expenditures. The indictment outlined $50,000 in credit card payments to that were funded through his campaign account to Cabela's, Best Buy, shooting range, it sounded like, just vacation in Colorado. And then one of the more interesting ones was they alleged that he purchased two recreational vehicles through the campaign fund, listed them for rent through this company out of Ohio, and then he rented them himself with campaign funds, counted that as revenue. And I think that one got him a tax evasion charge as well because he didn't report that revenue. The indictment alleges a whole lot of type of scheming to that regard that got him into a little bit of trouble.
Now, Charlie, we've seen a lot of interesting ways to use campaign money in the past. Does this anything here stand out to you more so?
Not really, other than what Jerry alluded to, the fact that he allegedly bought these vehicles, leased them, he put them up for lease under one name, leased them under a different name, and then the lease money, the rental of the vehicles flowed back to him under the first name. Now, I think that was pretty creative, pretty imaginative. I don't recall anybody being, what would you say, quite that deceptive. And it's interesting because back in the day, you could use your campaign funds for whatever you wanted to, as long as you declared them as income tax, or declared them as income and paid taxes to the federal government, to the state government. In fact, there was years ago, there was one downstate senator who used campaign funds to help pay the costs of the nursing home costs for his wife before she passed away. And that was all legal. But then we changed the rules and said, no, you can no longer use campaign funds for your personal use. They have to be for legitimate campaign expenses. And so I guess the senator was perhaps operating under the old system. Although, as I say, this kind of phony leasing deal, it was a little bit much even for back in the day.
Just a couple of minutes left here. Jerry, I want to go back to you. You covered the Republicans this week, at least a couple of Republicans, discussing a plan that they have would create a way for, well, several things, but also to initiate recall of an elected official midterm. Can you talk about what they're looking to do here, and does it have any chance of going anywhere?
Yeah, they called it the Voter Empowerment Project. I reached out to the leadership in the Senate for the Democratic leadership. One of the other measures was to give voters the opportunity to repeal a recently passed state law. For example, a tax increase. They had to file the petitions within 90 days or whatever. All three of the things that they were looking to do are constitutional amendments that would require supermajority of lawmakers, which is obviously a ton of Democratic support it would need. And the spokespeople for the Senate president and speaker said they hadn't even been really even approached on these. I think the Republicans know they're probably not going to go anywhere this year, maybe ever. I think it was just the opportunity to get these ideas out there into the public at this point.
And Charlie, you wanted to, I think, weigh in on this too.
No, I found it interesting when they talked about the idea of allowing citizens initiatives for any article of the Constitution. Well, that issue came up at the Constitutional Convention, and it was first considered by the committee that was reviewing the procedures for constitutional amendments, and that committee voted 5-4 to not have an initiative plan. Later, the issue came up again on the floor, and one of the delegates, a guy named David Davis, a former Republican state senator from Bloomington, said, and I'm quoting here, "I can't help wondering what would happen tomorrow if someone started circulating three petitions for constitutional amendment, one to eliminate the income tax, another to eliminate the personal property tax, and a third, perhaps, to eliminate the sales tax. Do you really think it would be very difficult to get the signatures necessary for the petition or to get the votes necessary for the passage of the adoption of each constitutional amendment in each of these three cases? And if that sort of thing can be produced by the initiative method, isn't this a very dangerous situation to create?" And so it was shot down, and among the people who voted against it were two very young Chicagoans, Richard M. Daley and Michael J. Madigan. And then they came up with the scaled-down version that we have now that limits it to the legislative article and form and structure.
Well, Illinois does have a recall provision for Illinois Governor Hanna. This was put in, I believe it was back in 2010, right on the heels of the Blagojevich situation, which he was impeached, removed from office. The law that the state has, though, is very difficult to explain. There's a lot of different ways to make this, or a lot of different things that have to happen to make it work to actually recall a governor. And some people say it doesn't work for that reason. This, I guess, would be a little bit more straightforward, but like Jerry was saying, Republicans just don't have the power to move this through right now.
Right. That's right. I mean, yeah, this in 2010, voters approved this constitutional amendment, but it's, you have to get something like 15% of voter signatures from, of total overall voters who, and then they have to come from like a certain amount of counties, and then it goes to the legislature, and you have to get a bipartisan number of lawmakers, an equal number of lawmakers from both parties in both the House and the Senate. It's just, it's not going to go anywhere, but it's good to talk about the power disparity that exists, I would say.
Okay, time now for our notes from the field. Jerry, let's go to you first.
Yeah, so we covered this week that the state will receive almost $20 million from a settlement reached between several attorneys general and the consulting firm McKinsey, which did work with the opioid manufacturer Purdue Pharma to sort of supercharge their sales, according to the settlement. So there's a $573 million settlement total. The proceeds are to be used to abate and address the impacts of the opioid epidemic throughout Illinois and the other participating states.
Charlie?
Well, the latest flash index compiled by Professor Gertz at the University of Illinois Institute of Government and Public Affairs shows that the state is continuing its slow recovery. In January, it's up to 96.3 from 95.9 in December, which is well below the pre-COVID level, but it's the highest reading since the pandemic began. And another area of good news in terms of the revenues is that for the first 7 months of this fiscal year, which runs until the end of June, base receipts to the general funds are up $2.4 billion, according to the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability. Part of it is because the impact of layoffs has affected more direly people in the lower wage or lower income workers rather than higher income workers. And so that's less of a hit. And also, the state economy has done better than what was expected. And so that's the good news, I guess, for the day.
All right. And Hannah?
Unfortunately, Springfield this week lost two kind of heavy hitters around the community, Tony Leone and Rosemarie Long. Tony Leone, I think a lot of people know him as the proprietor of Passfield House and in at 835, just really good, kind man. I knew him just a tiny bit. He called me out of the blue in, I think it was the November or December, and he just wanted to talk about Matt again, and we did. It was great. We promised that we would have lunch sometime after COVID. And Rosemarie Long was the chair of the Sangamon County Republican Party. Didn't know her, but from everything that I've seen, just a really good, kind woman. And they will both be missed.
All right. That's all the time we have for State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and Jerry Nowicki with Capital News Illinois. Get a podcast of our show. It's available at nprillinois.org or through the NPR One app. And production assistance for the program was provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.